So what episode are we on now? 61?
61, yeah.
61. Welcome to episode 61. We have Flynn and James Allen both at the same time this week, which is it's been a bit of a, aside from the norm of the last two. How's it going, lads? And Albanian James has got his microphone on, off.
For once, I did that the wrong way around. A spectacular week, closing in on that first home, that first mortgage, financial servitude for the next 30 years. It's exciting stuff. But other than that, pretty good, man. What about you, Flynn? How have you been getting on?
All good. Yeah, really good. Managed to get back off the cigarettes for the first time in about 6 months. It's been about just this week so far, no cigarettes. Been getting back on the bicycle, trying to get fit again. Feeling good, man. And off to Valencia tomorrow for the long weekend.
Nice.
Go on the long weekends. Is that with the fancy one?
Not with the fancy woman this time. This is just with a few pals. One of my mates has moved down there. We're going to go and do a big Easter cook-up, big roast.
So you're not driving down there now? By driving, I mean on the bicycle.
Riding not on the bicycle. There. That would take up most of the weekend.
Wouldn't get much chance for actually chilling out with your mates, innit?
Yeah. Land there. Like, see you later. All right, I've got to go back. Now, I've got a coach at 10 in the morning, so I'm going to bring a bottle of rum for that.
Yeah. Good man. Good man. Love that style.
All right, so for the episode this week, we have a Premier League review, including the blockbuster tie between Man City and Liverpool that we get to relive all over again because it's happening again this Saturday in the FA Cup semis. And most probably, or there's a good chance it might be happening in the Champions League final as well. So we also have a Champions League review. Two English teams made the semis. One falls just short after a heroic fight back. That was a great game between Chelsea and Real Madrid. We have the five things as usual, and of course, the review of a tremendous card at UFC 273, including podcast favorite Khamzat Chimaev, Aljo versus Jan 2, which was controversial, to say the least, and a masterclass from Alexander Volkanovski. So, so we'll get off with the preamble, Romo, and I had no idea what to put in for this this week, lads. So I just kind of like threw something in there last minute, just something that I was watching on YouTube earlier, and it is, how on earth does Paddy Pimblett look in great shape when he performs in the octagon? And then literally, not even weeks later, I'll put weeks later there. I think that's generous. Literally like days later, he looks like a fat lead singer in an Oasis cover band. Like, can somebody share the science behind this?
Well, I did see him in St. Ives after his UFC debut, coming out of a Thai restaurant that I was on my way into. And a lot of coconut milk getting sloshed around in those dishes, let me tell you. And he looked a size compared to what he was in the cage. I think it comes down to a couple of factors. One being that he must cut a lot of weight. You know, what is it? Is he 155, 170?
Lightweight he fights at? So what's that?
155, yeah. So he looks like a big guy anyway. And obviously when you cut the weight, you deplete yourself. And I think once you start to refuel on the level that some of these guys refuel, like obviously they gorge, they binge after 8-12 weeks of really steady dieting, I think the body just soaks all that up. And I think part of Paddy Pimblett's problem is that 25% of that weight goes to his cheeks. So he does look like a hamster, like storing food away for Christmas. So in terms of his body type, it's unfortunate, but I don't think it's by any means uncommon with MMA athletes.
Go on, Phil.
I saw, yeah, it does seem like a lot of the weight seems to go to his cheeks first. But I did see a video that he released, and I swear it must have only been about 3 days after the fight. And so what, he fought at 155, that's about, it's like 70 kilos or something. Within those few days, he shot up to 91 kilos, man. That's like more than like 3 stone or something. And he was just talking about what he'd been binging on. He was eating like 10,000 calories a day, like going to Nando's more than once a day. The guy's just, he's insane, man.
Well, bear in mind that after he weighs in at 155, he'll walk into the cage somewhere close to 170, 175 if he's cutting a lot. So by the time he gets out of the cage, he's probably already made up half that difference, but still a lot on the body, a lot for your system to process. I mean, I think you can only do that so many times without it impacting your career. But as a young man, I'm hoping it doesn't happen quite yet before we get to see Paddy the Baddy reach his full potential in the UFC.
And when it comes to cutting weight, like, so they have 24 hours to try and basically cut as much as they want. So from the weigh-in to the point that they step in the octagon. So they can basically put on weight if they want to be heavier or lose weight. How does that work? No, that 24-hour period?
The 24-hour period after the weigh-in. So in MMA especially, when they weigh in, they are as light as they're going to get. And they sometimes will only touch down at that weight for an hour or two. They will all put on weight after that. The question is how much and how their cut has been. So if they're strict dieting for 10, 12 weeks before their fight, which most of them do, some of the shape that these guys are in is like ridiculous. So they hit the dieting pretty hard. But in the last week, that's when they start cutting their water and their fluids, and they start taking in less water, and they start doing saunas and hot baths and that kind of thing, really drying themselves out. Now, there are myriad ways to do this, some healthy. I mean, none of it's really healthy, but there are safer ways to do it and there are unsafe ways to do it. And it all depends on what road you go down. As far as I'm aware, in the UFC, unlike with some sanctioning organizations in boxing, there's no rehydration clause. So I think the IBF has a rule where you can't weigh in. You can't weigh more than 10 pounds over what you weighed in at if you're in a title fight. So if you weigh in at 147, you can't weigh more than 157 on the night that you fight. That's kind of a way that they try and control it. But obviously, fighters will look for any way to kind of game the system to get any advantage that they can.
There you go. I know there was a reason why I put that in there, because I wanted that great breakdown from Jim regarding regarding making weight and cutting and etc. So we'll move on to the footy chat, shall we? Let's talk about that Premier League game between Man City and Liverpool. 2-2 it finished. Pep opted to leave out top goal scorer Riyad Mahrez. I think he's still their top goal scorer in all competitions. On the bench, he was yet again in a big Premier League game. And he's only started 39% of Premier League games for Man City, which might surprise a lot of people. And he's been used primarily in the Champions League as more of an impact player off the bench. More on that later. And Jack Grealish was another that missed out. Sterling and Phil Foden were preferred in the front three, with a surprise selection of Gabriel Jesus as the nine. Grealish has only got 2 goals and 2 assists in 21 appearances for a team that score goals for fun. Hasn't been the most productive of seasons for the ex-Villa man in the first season in Manchester. And for Liverpool, Klopp didn't spring many surprises with their team selection. Joel Matip came back in the side to replace Konate after their Champions League tie midweek. And Jordan Henderson started with Thiago and Fabinho in midfield. They went with mainstays Mo Salah, Sadio Mane and Diogo Jota as the front three. Did anybody else catch this game?
I caught the highlights, but judging from the group chat, this was a high-level game. And like you could see from the scoreline, from what I can gather, Man City, I don't know if dominated is too strong of a word, but they definitely had control of the first half. Liverpool, fair play to have managed to creep their way back into the game against one of the best teams in the world. And I think that was the sense I got from both watching the highlights and from the pundits. I've got a question for you though, Bissett. We spoke a lot about how Pep Guardiola, on the rare occasion, the Champions League final being a notable example, sometimes can overthink his tactics. Did you see evidence of that here, i.e. with Mahrez, for example, and Gabriel Jesus? Or was this pretty much what you expected given the way things lie?
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't think it was a case of him overthinking it. Obviously, it was Fernandinho, wasn't it, in the Champions League final that I think he left out when it would have made sense for him to be in that starting lineup. He hasn't been making the team as much as he was in previous years. But I think tactically, I think this was like, it was like a game of chess. I think these two are probably the best coaches in the world right now. And it was total football, really. I think both teams played attack as the best form of defence, and it made for a thrilling encounter. And, you know, for a game that featured such elite football, the first half was kind of marred with like mistakes, really, in the goals, albeit fine margins. Liverpool, I think they switched off for De Bruyne's goal, which started with a quick free kick, and then it was like poor goalkeeper for Madison, which you don't say that a lot, which allowed Liverpool to level. And then a sumptuous angled cutback pass from Trent Alexander-Arnold, who's an absolute don at the minute. I think we praise him a lot on this podcast. And then did you see Edison about 10 minutes? I think it was about the 25th minute. He had everybody's ass flapping, but he was like cool as a cucumber. He was like, I think he went to play a pass, and then he, whether he was off balance or he saw something that he didn't like, he sort of checked and then like went for the pass again. Diogo Jota was like literally, I want to say, yard away from the goal line. And when he played the pass, it was actually on the goal line when he played it. But like, he just didn't give a fuck, man. He was just like, nah, it's all right, man. I had it under control.
Didn't Courtois did something similar against Chelsea? And I was just thinking, mate, as if you're Cruyff turning in your own 6-yard box with lads flying at you. I think it was like the last 10 minutes of the game or something. I was thinking, goalkeepers can get a bit brave. Like, this possession football for the keepers can get a bit over the top. But as you say, like, a lot of composure, a lot of skill, and the right temperament to do it on such a big stage.
Yeah, and it was, as you say, it was elite level football, and even from the goalkeepers, we're seeing it. And Gabriel Jesus, who was a bit of a surprise selection in that team, made it 2-1. And then Mane scored within like 50 seconds of the restart, I think it was. And then, that was just a high quality goal from a Liverpool team that I really like playing, you know, the at the best, at their top of their ability. You know what I mean? When was the last time they lost? I think they'd only conceded like a handful of goals prior to that game. I think maybe two or three off the top of my head since January or something. They got crazy, crazy defensive record. And, you know, they've been beating teams like consistently for a long time. And then Mahrez, who we mentioned earlier, he came on and he received criticism for his missed chance at the end. I don't know if you either you saw this, but I was listening to the TIFO football podcast earlier on in the week, and they was talking about if that would have been a Messi, a Lewandowski, a Benzema, would they have been able to score in that moment? And it was kind of, I think he miscontrolled it initially. And then I think he made the right play in trying to chip the keeper, but it just didn't quite come off technically. I don't know if either of you saw this, but, you know, I think is that a fair criticism to say that he should have, you know, I think he should have buried it, but to say that he isn't quite technically as gifted as some of the top strikers in the world?
To say that he isn't quite on par technically as Lewandowski, Messi and Benzema is no insult at all. I think you only have to look at some of the passes he was making against Atletico Madrid the other night to just see how technically astute and capable he is. I did watch the highlights again. I must have seen this chance, but I can't remember specifically what happened. I'd have to look at it again. But that's almost like a compliment to name that short list of players and be like, yeah, these lads would have buried it, but maybe everyone else would struggle. It's one of those, isn't it? It's like Riyad Mahrez is a sick footballer. We just like Trent, we big him up all the time on the pod, but sometimes even the best players miss chances. So, you know, over the course of a season, over the course of a career, I think he'll come up on the bigger end of chances taken versus those that are missed.
Quick question there for you, Bissett. I want to go back to when you mentioned Pep choosing Jesus at the beginning and making like surprise choices. You, as a burgeoning coach, would you ever consider going for unorthodox tactics like that in such a key and crucial game so late in a season? Do you think that is something worth doing? Is he trying to catch people off? What's the situation with this?
Well, I think over the course of the season, he's played sort of Phil Foden as a 9. I don't think Riyad Mahrez, he usually plays out in the wide position. Same with Jack Grealish. Sterling perhaps may have played in that position. And Gabriel Jesus, I wouldn't say he's an out-and-out natural 9. They haven't really had one since Sergio Aguero left. So it's been kind of like he's been able to adopt his tactics based on the personnel he has available. So I think that's been a sign of a great coach as well, because it's not just the players you have at your disposal and the system you like to play, but it's been able to coach your players up to be able to play different positions. And I think he's done that really well with like Gundogan as well. He's played in that position at times. I think in the Champions League final, he might have started off as the 9. But he was scoring, I think it was early on in this podcast's existence, we were talking about Gundogan, and he had a really rich vein of scoring form. And I think in that moment, I think he was playing as the 9. Might have been just after Sergio Aguero left the club. So, and obviously Man City have got the financial power to be able to bring someone like Haaland in, someone like Mbappe in. But it'd be a question of, like, do they need to as well? Because at the moment, they're one of the best teams in the world. And if they're not playing without a natural nine, like Harry Kane might have been, you know, if he would have gone there in January, that would have changed their system slightly, because we're starting to see players like Harry Kane evolve into different sort of, you know, a different kind of player anyway. So, like, to answer your question, I think Guardiola, I wouldn't want to call him a genius, tactical genius, but he's not far off it, man. We're going to be talking about him for, you know, his 20-year managerial career or wherever, however long he decides to stay in the game. And then after that, we're going to talk about him being one of the best coaches, like, of all time. I think that's without a doubt. I think what he's done with that team, and we're going to talk about that a little bit more later when we talk about the Champions League tie against Atleti. But I just think that he's becoming, you know, a legend of the game in terms of coaching and the way he can coach players up and transform them into different, you know, different roles, and like making sure that they can adapt their qualities to the system that he wants to play. I think he's absolutely fantastic. I mean, look at De Bruyne. Like, he's been like unbelievable, hasn't he, for how many years now? He wasn't really Jose Mourinho couldn't get the best out of him at Chelsea. I think he went to, was it Wolfsburg or Werder Bremen? He was, you know, he started to sort of, we started to see his qualities there, and then he came to Man City and he's just been class.
I tell you what, it was De Bruyne who went to Wolfsburg and then came back to prove his quality. But I got a question for you. If by some universal happenstance, Pep Guardiola ended up as the manager at Manchester United, could he sort it out? Could he fix it? Do you know what I mean? Especially considering recent results. Do you reckon he could go in there and with the personnel that they've got at the minute and with his tactical knowledge and his training methods, do you think you'd see an improvement in the Man United that we've seen in this season and season before?
Well, I don't want to call the man Bob the Builder, but I reckon he could fix it, man. I reckon he could go in there and get instant change at that club. I mean, look at what Xavi's done at Barcelona. He's gone in there and he has completely transformed that team. I think there was a picture the other day. It was like where Barcelona were when Xavi came in and where they are now. I think they were like in ninth position after like 11 games or something. And then now they're what, second? I don't know how many points are off Real Madrid. It might be about six. I'm not 100% sure. But they were about 10 a few weeks ago. But obviously they made that up by beating them. And they haven't lost in, I don't know how many games, quite a few months now. So I think Pep Guardiola would be the sort of coach that could go in there. He would get the big players to come and play for him as well. And that's no disrespect to Jose Mourinho and, you know, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, the coaches that have been there recently, and obviously Ralf Rangnick now, and Ten Hag, if it's going to be him that goes into in the future. But Ten Hag, are players going to want to say, right, I want to go and play for him? And have Manchester United got that? We're going to go on to talk about Manchester United and their result against Everton, but have they got these sort of, how can I say, the reputation to be able to bring those big players in at the moment? Right now, you know, will the best players in on the planet, will the Mbappes of the world, will the, you know, Benzema of the world, will Haaland, will they be, Man United won't be their first choice. Not like Man United was a lot of players' first choice probably, I don't know, like a decade ago.
They've got a problem because they can afford to pay transfer fees, extortionate transfer fees, and extortionate wages. They are still a financial powerhouse. But as you say, the situation, the playing situation and the team dynamic over the last few years, you'd stay clear, wouldn't you? You wouldn't. Mbappe, Haaland, all the top kids in the world you could name, they wouldn't want to go there. Do you know what I mean? You'd be looking at more, maybe like, what's his name for Benfica? Nunes. Maybe he would go somewhere like that. Like Arsenal are interested in him. Like, that's the kind of, we make the Arsenal-Man U comparison a lot, but I think they're pretty much commensurate teams in terms of their profile. Maybe not historically, but certainly at the minute.
I'd agree with that completely, Jim. I'd say definitely. I'd say reputationally, I'd say they are.
Yeah, so like, again, Arsenal wouldn't get those kind of players, the Mbappes, the Haalands. You can spend, they just wouldn't, realistically speaking, even though they've probably got less money at hand. But yeah, it's... when you see things like on Saturday, well, last week, when like the nature of the goal, like if you don't mind me skipping ahead, it was like a deflection off Harry Maguire. I don't think we need to kick that man any more than we already have, but it was just unfortunate.
Did you see there was a clip of him during that game. I think it was either the 1-1 draw against Leicester or the 1-0 loss against Everton. But he claimed to the referee for a handball against his own player. So like Matt, I think it was Matt that handballed it, and it was like, ref, handball. That guy is so lost right now. I don't think he knows what's going on, man.
Yeah, well, to be fair, my head would be a jungle as well if I was just every ball that hit me ended up in my own net, which is what happened there. But it's still interesting where teams and managers can get confidence from, because you can imagine Lampard and Everton being like, these lads are at sixes and sevens at the minute. Similar to the way Sean Dyche was the other week talking about Everton. These lads don't know how to win a game of football. And you'd walk out there with a completely different attitude. And I can't believe that. But you said in the group chat, trust Everton to pull out this victory after we've been bashing them, like pretty much guaranteeing they go down, man.
And the old classic, right? Sean Dyche wrote Lampard's team talk for him. If I was Lampard, I would have put that up. I would have got that quote from Sean Dyche and put it up in the dressing room just before we're going out, you know, at Goodison Park. Like, they don't know how to win a game. Like, you wouldn't need to say anything, man. Just put that up. To say, lads, you seen what Sean Dyche just said about us? We are not getting relegated. Look at that. Go out there and put in a proper performance for your home fans. And you know, he probably wouldn't have had to say anything, but he did switch to a back four. He played two double pivots by the bollocks to me. He brought back in Fabian Delph. Alan, I think, was playing alongside him. It looked like a 4-2-3-1 to me. And all of a sudden, they look competitive. I wouldn't say it's rocket science, man. I'm not shocked. He's changed his system, and it worked for him. And this is what we've been saying for the last 4 weeks. So I think we can take some solace that we might have got something right there, perhaps. But Coleman looked like he had a great game as well at right back and not part of a back five. And I think the two sixes did help him allow to cover more ground in midfield, add extra protection for that back four, which has been really, really leaky and, you know, really on unsteady ground. There's no surprise Mason Holgate wasn't selected. He's been poor recently. Ben Godfrey and Michael Keane were the centre-back pairing. And I think United, they looked like they started well. They had a couple of early chances. Rashford looked a little bit more improved than he has been of late. But it was ultimately Everton who got the breakthrough. And then, to be honest, United, by the looks at the highlights, they looked like they were only threatening from set pieces. And I think they had the odd, like, speculative shot from range, but they didn't really test Pickford. I think he had a decent game, but they didn't really test him. And to me, like, teams that are only being successful at set pieces, so they look dangerous from corners, look dangerous from free kicks, and teams that are having long shots at Pickford, not just Pickford, any goalkeeper. But to me, that signifies a lack of confidence and a real, like, they're bereft of ideas. I think that is where Man United are right now. And I think, you know, conversations surrounding management and, you know, uncertainty in that regard, it's not reflecting well. It's not translating well to performances on the pitch. And I think they could do well to get some clarity on the situation with the management now, because I feel like they're probably waiting for the end of the season, but it's like they're dying a slow death. And I don't know what they're playing for. What are Man United playing for right now? They're out of the FA Cup. They're out of the Champions League, realistically only playing for a Europa League spot. Pogba just looks like he's strolling around. He's saying that United have got nothing to play for. Bruno Fernandes has just signed a new contract, so he's all right. He's getting paid. So he's putting in poor performances, as you see with a lot of players. Once they get that big money contract, they start to like ease off a little bit. And then, you know, Fred's the best player in the team. And Flynn, I remember you saying that your mate was like, Bissett doesn't know what he's fucking talking about, because Fred's been our best player, but he has been shifted like 5 or 10 yards up the pitch. He's not playing in that sort of holding role as much now. He does look like he's starting to, you know, roam forward a bit and be involved in the attack and build up. And I think that suited him, man. It's not, I don't think it's particularly down to, you know, him being a terrible footballer, which we have said on the past, to be fair, but maybe he's in a new role now, and that, you know, he's flourishing.
Well, with their form being, how would you describe it? It's not mediocre. It's like you say, encapsulating Pogba's attitude. They're kind of just existing waiting for the end of the season to come. And that's not a good place to be mentally if you're going to turn in high intensity, good performances, which is what you need for success in the Premier League. I actually thought that Ten Hag had been announced officially as the manager next season, but you're saying he's not. So that's obviously going to play a part in terms of what are the plans next season? What are we going to be playing like? Who are the players we want to bring in? Who's what members of the squad feel confident keeping their place? That all affects the dynamic. And obviously you see Spurs wallop Villa 4-0, and then you see Arsenal lose 2-1 to Brighton. If Man United run good form right now, they could be top four, but they're just there is a word that I'm trying to. They just seem like they're not bothered, or they can't bring themselves back from the mental malaise that they're in. I'd be screwing if I was a United fan, but that you could say that for the last 5 years at least.
Shout out to my friend that you mentioned, Tim, big fan of the podcast. He listens every week, so shout out to Tim, and he's the friend we're going to go see in Valencia tomorrow. And I got a question that I imagine he wants to ask you, Bissett. What's the plan for Man U next season? What do you see happening?
Try and lure one of the best coaches in the world to come and manage your football club. Do you know what I mean? They're not going to. Obviously, they can't. They can't do that right now because all the best managers in the world are taken. I'd say that is probably Thomas Tuchel, Pep Guardiola, and Klopp. They're the best three coaches in the world right now, and they're all at their rivals. So we're not used to that. As Man United fans, I'm not a Man United fan, but I have historically liked to see them do well. So what do they do from here? Is Erik ten Hag going to be the answer? I'm really not sure, man.
Realistically, what can they do next season? I mean, you say they couldn't get one of the best managers in the world, but I mean, they surprised everyone and just got Ronnie this year. They got one of the best players in the world out of nowhere. Could they do it with a manager?
He's on a free though, wasn't it? That was on a free. And I think there was that whole nostalgic aspect to that and his age as well. We're not talking 29-year-old Ronnie who's banging in 500 goals for Real Madrid. You know what I mean? We're talking 36-year-old Ronnie who's coming off two mediocre seasons with Juventus. The stars aligned a little bit on that one. And I think that move kind of reflects where United are at. Like Ten Hag rather than, say, you know, Pep or whatever. Pep's a bad example because of the City connection, but this kind of lower tier of the highest caliber of coaches is what they're looking at, really. Because look at the headache that managers have had going to United. It's not only players that would think twice about going there. If you think that like you're not going to have full control of your squad and the conditions you're training and you play under, why would you go there as a coach as well? It just seems like, I don't know, man. I don't want to say relegation. No, I'm joking. But
but realistically, you're asking to say what would be the expectations for a Man United fan next season?
Mm-hmm.
It would be challenge for top four. It's not challenge for Premier League title. There is no way Manchester United are challenging on Manchester City, Liverpool, or even Chelsea's level next year. They just ain't. Like fourth is the best that they can hope for. And that I think that is realistic.
Are we saying right now, here and now, end of next season, Man U finish fourth? Is that the ball?
They're not going to finish any higher than fourth. That's for sure. Because I think for a long time with their transfers, it's been trying to fit square pegs in round holes. And I think the signing of Jadon Sancho, the signing of Varane, the signing of Harry Maguire, the signing of Cristiano Ronaldo, they have been those kind of like, right, do they really fit the system and the philosophy that Man United want to take forward? But because they haven't had a manager that stayed there long enough and tried to sort of build a culture around the club and, you know, trying to, you know, embed his own philosophy and his own tactics and his own system, you haven't been able to have these players that fit. Like, it's just kind of like they don't quite fit at the moment. It does. And they still haven't got players that I would say are Manchester United caliber. Of like, you know, the Fergie days in midfield, like they just ain't. Scott McTominay just is not good enough, I don't think, to be in that team.
But there's nothing to fit into. It's not that the players don't fit. It's, as you say, because the revolving door keeps spinning. It's like you can't embed a philosophy in 6 months or a year. And you get in these players and obviously there's a lot of pressure from the board to get these commercially viable players in, i.e. Pogba. And that looked like a coup at the time, but in the sense like, okay, now you've got this midfielder with certain strengths that probably work better in the Italian league and the way that works and the way that operates. Now you've got him. Where does he fit in? It's not this, like you said yourself, Varane's played fairly well in a lot of the games he's been in, and a few really top level performances. But if there's no philosophical bedrock, and players don't know what's expected of them, that's something. What you hear about Pep is that they drill. Every player knows what's expected of them at all times, and then they're super fit, they're super alert, and then they just get after it, and they're competitive with anyone in the world. I don't think you could rightly say that about Man United, but again, it might be an unfair comparison because of the trajectories of the two clubs over the past, it's going on 10 years now, isn't it? Really scary.
Yeah, it's nearly 10 years since they've had, a success since Fergie left.
Here's one for you. Say the board, they're sick of Ten Hag. Let's fast forward a few months. They're sick of him. They approach you.
Not giving him very long, then. You're giving him a couple of months, yeah? A
couple of months in the off-season. They just didn't like the way he was training.
Hasn't even played the first game. Yeah, just don't really like your training sessions, mate. Like, let's just part ways.
They're like, we've heard about this hot new prospect over in New York. They've seen you work with the Red Bull under-9s girls team. And they're impressed. They sit you down and they give you a cigar, obviously. And they're like, Bissett, what's the plan? We want you next year. How do you get us top of the Premier League?
I'll be shaking like a shitting dog, mate, to be fair. But I don't know, man. I think they need an overhaul. I'd probably say you need to give me 2 years at least. You need to give me a lot of money. And we need to build a team like over a 2 year period. Even if we finish 12th or 13th or something, you need to give that manager enough time to be able to really embed his philosophy and get behind him and, you know, bring in players that are going to suit the system. I think that's what United need to do with their next manager. If it's Ten Hag, give him 2 years, man. Just really like bite the bullet. Even if you finish outside the Champions League places for 2 years running, all right, as long as you can see that there's something there and they're starting to develop, yeah, I think that's just what they need, man. You're just looking at all the successful teams. Like Tuchel was a bit of an anomaly, really. He came in and was like impactful straight away. But like Guardiola, Klopp, they've been there for what? I think Klopp's been there since 2015, so 7 years now. Guardiola was maybe the year or two after that. So they've both been there for over 5 years now. And it really shows on the field, doesn't it? It shows when Manchester City and Liverpool play each other. It's like they all know exactly what their roles and responsibilities were. Like just as Jim was saying, man, they all know exactly what their role is in that team. And they don't try and overcomplicate things. I think that's a very, very important thing about like even elite level football. You don't need to overcomplicate it, man. Just play, be in the right position at the right time. Play the pass. Make sure you scan over the field. Like I watched something with De Bruyne. Somebody did like a little study on him. And they were like focusing for the moments where he was scanning around the field. And they were saying that he has one of the best scan percentages. So he's constantly looking over his shoulder to see where the space is, see where the opposition players are. And he's able to use that information in like fractions of a second to be able to decide what to do. And that's why he's one of the best passers on the planet. Not just passing as well, but just like one of the best midfielders on the planet. So I just think that, you know, and that's something you can't coach really. But at the end of the day, I can imagine that Guardiola is making sure that all the players are aware of things like that. Do you know what I mean? Like something that's the sort of stuff that he's trying to embed in his footballing philosophy as well.
I saw Kane do a similar thing against Villa. I swear to God, against Villa, it was an assist to Son where he had a big look around like that as the ball was coming to him. And it was just a perfect nod on. And I thought, that was half a second. And he's took in the entire picture and recognised what he's supposed to do and executed it at the same time. Now, again, 4-0. I don't even think he got on the score sheet, did he, against Villa, Kane?
Jim, right you are. He didn't score, but he did get a couple of assists, I think. And I think that's been his role in the team, hasn't it, for the last sort of couple of months. He has been that sort of deep-lying playmaker. And he's been really providing for his teammates. Kulusevski's probably been one of the best signings of January that we can think of for a few years. I'm sure Jim will have a few Arsenal ones. Kulusevski's been brilliant, man. Signed him in January. He's been really, really good. And then, you know, Son Heung-min got a hat-trick. How long has he been at Spurs now? He's been there for a long time, man. He's been a great player for them. I still think he's probably one of the best. He's probably in the top 10 attackers at least in the Premier League. But to be fair, you wouldn't be forgiven. And like, the, you know, Villa fans, I think they probably back me up on this, but you'd be forgiven for being mistaken about which team won 4-0 based on the stats. Villa won, you know, they won the possession stats. They had more possession. That doesn't mean anything, but they had more shots on target. They had more shots in total. They had more touches. They had more passes. Tottenham had to have more tackles and more clearances, which suggests that, you know, Villa were doing well in that department in the final third. So to be honest, like that scoreline, I think reflects, you know, what's the word? It humbles slightly Spurs. Is that the right term?
Flatters.
Flatters, that's the one. It flatters Spurs slightly. So, I mean, the goals, I think it was just a case of like, in the first half, Villa, it was just unbelievable how they didn't score. Looking back at the highlights, you know, I think they should have gone in level, if not even winning that first half. And then it was just a case of quality, man. It was quality of the finishing, quality of the movement off the ball from Son Heung-min and Kulusevski, and the passing and just the timing of the runs and just being in the right moment at the right time. Then, of course, the finishes. All three of Son's finishes were just world-class. Like, no keeper stopping them, man. I think two of them were, like, off the post, like, posting in. It was, like, literally, like, a perfect performance from him. And that doesn't get spoken about enough. And I don't know why he isn't in the conversation, man, because, like, he's consistently been getting goals and assists for, what, 3-4 years, like, consistently with Spurs now. So why isn't he in the conversation of being one of the better strikers in the Premier League?
It's the same thing we saw in the World Cup with Sterling and Kane. Kane is this prototypical, like, Roy of the Rovers type figure that a lot of people, especially football fans, especially England fans, are going to be able to identify with more on that level. He plays for England. He's like, is he nearly record scorer, or he is record scorer now? He's still got 3 or 4 years left playing at the very highest level. He's someone similar to, what's the name, the tennis player, Naomi Osaka, and what's the name, Raducanu. He fits that kind of bill where, like, it's the image as well as the performances. He's just more relatable. Obviously, he's going to get more credit, more praise in the press, in this country at least.
Are you saying because he's a white man?
Well, whenever I hear anyone on TV or podcasts just use that kind of terminology, it makes my skin crawl. But yeah, basically it is. Like, most England fans are fucking white bald geezers who look like me, innit? And from a selling perspective, from a communication perspective, it's very tribal, like primal. It's advertising, innit? It's like as simple as that. But you're right, Son has been outstanding for a long time. And he's almost like, it's not just Kane, it's him and Kane and whoever's coming in beside him. Obviously, your man, the new one.
Dejan Kulusevski.
So it rolls off the tongue, innit? It's like Magomed Sharapov in the UFC. But yeah, it's not just Kane doing it, but he's the focal point of it. But Son, tremendous, tremendous player. When was he playing for, like, Hamburg back in the day or something, when he was like 21, ripping it up? He was killing it, man.
Just while you find them stats there, quick Son and Kane fact. I think we touched on this a few months ago when they were about to hit the record, but they've surpassed it now. Harry Kane and Son Heung-min have combined more combined goals than any other duo in Premier League history, with 37 goals between them. They've gone past Drogba and Lampard, with the previous champs of that.
Yeah, because they were Kane in the bookies, weren't they, when they were doing, I think it was Sky Bet were doing some special. It was like Son to assist Kane and Kane to assist Son. It was like 40-1. And like bare people were like backing it. And it happened like two, I think like at least twice in a few weeks. So like it'd gone from like 40-1 to like 22-1 because it was happening so often. Do you know what I mean? So it's very rare you have that, you know, Dwight York and Andy Cole partnership. We don't really see that much in the Premier League, but
Alan Shearer, Chris Sutton, SAS back there in the day.
And to bring it back to race as well, three of the duos we've talked about are actually interracial couples.
There you go, man. It's all love on the Ball Chat Sports Podcast.
Ben, you might be onto something there. Add that to the list of research stuff that you got to do.
How many interracial striking partners are like successful?
For hey, that cities? Would be a great study, honestly. If you were like doing like what do you call it when you're at uni, a dissertation. If you were doing like a dissertation on like sports or something, like that'd be banging, man. I'd be interested to read that, Flynn. I'm looking forward to that.
You'd get booted out for that quick time, mate. You'd be gone. You'd be like, you're not going to start measuring people's school sizes, are you, for this one? Are you going to leave that?
You were going to say measuring somewhere else then. But anyway, we'll move on. There's another couple of results. We're not going to talk too much about the results because we need to get to the Champions League. Chelsea absolutely destroyed Southampton. They've been really weird. They had that great run of form for about 9 or 10 games where I think they were like third in the form table. Then they've been shocking since last 4 or 5 games. I don't think they've had a win. Chelsea were brilliant. Mason Mount, another player that probably doesn't get spoke about enough.
We bollocked him in the Euros. But again, we'll talk about his performance in the Champions League. He was tremendous. And in the last couple of weeks especially, he's really reminded me of kind of Pulisic from a season or two ago, not making those kind of impacts. So look, if someone's playing like shit or they're not making an impact, we're entitled to say that. And if they improve their form, as we're giving him credit now, so there's no shame in tracking events as they come upon us.
And yeah, let's talk about that Chelsea mountain to climb that they had on Tuesday night. Obviously, they were 3-1 down from the first leg. And to be honest, I thought they were strolling through at 3-0. What did you make of it, Jim?
Well, it looked like they needed a miracle. And low, Yahweh granted them his blessings. Listen, for the first 75 minutes at least, which might cast aspersions on your ideological values. But Mason Mount, Antonio Rudiger, and even the notoriously goal-shy Timo Werner all scored to take the Blues 3-0 up, which made it 4-3 on aggregate, which would have seen them through. But we should have known there was a scorpion in the Kinder Egg. When Marcus Alonso's goal was disallowed for the slightest of handballs, Madrid's destiny threatened to reveal itself when substitute Rodrigo levelled the tie in the 80th minute from a sublime Luka Modric pass. Can we just take a minute of silence for that outside of the right boot? Straight into, oh my God, sublime. Makes me dribble just thinking about it. And then their destiny, it went the full Monty. When this guy I've never heard of clinched it in the 96th minute with a lucky header. His name escapes me. I can't quite put my finger on where he's from.
Yeah, I don't think he's really been playing at a good level for a long time. Like, I'm not really sure where he's coming from, this guy.
I think they've got him on loan from like some kind of South African team or something. I just don't know where he's from. But
he's finally impressed me, I'll tell you that.
Karim Benzema, inshallah, bro. And listen, I didn't watch the game, but I woke up to the gaseous emissions from the group the next morning. Bissett, what was it like watching this live? Because I could feel the excitement coming through the WhatsApp group.
To be honest, it looked like they were cruising, man. That they had such control over the game and over Real Madrid that it didn't look like it was in doubt, to be honest. I think even when they got the goal back, Real Madrid, there was still the feeling that Chelsea might be able to come through it. Unfortunately, I had to dip off to work like the full-time whistle, so I didn't actually catch extra time. But I mean, yeah, let's talk about it again. Luka Modric, that pass. And that's when you're playing in Champions League quarterfinals and you're talking about playing against players and teams that have the caliber of that ilk, of Luka Modric's ilk, like you're always susceptible, man. It was one switch off. One little concentration lapse from Chelsea. I think it was like a ball headed down. Modric scanned over his shoulder, checked into the space, and that was it. Like, what player in the world thinks to play the outside of the boot, early cross, swung in like that? And like some of the goals he scored with the outside of his boot. I think he's the outside of the boot master. Can we just say he's the best player in the world with using the outside of his boot? Like that goal in the Euros that he scored, remember that? Outside of the boot. Swing it.
Other than Carlos Quaresma, the specialist who necessitated that technique because he didn't have a left foot. But yeah, he's, and bear in mind, he's probably 45 years old and he weighs like 7 stone. So big ups to Luka Modric.
In the 126th minute, he was still like absolutely pressing everybody, Janani, all over the pitch. Like he's got an engine like you couldn't believe, man. So yeah, absolutely brilliant. I thought Chelsea were great. I think the penalty, the disallowed goal was correct by the rules of the game. But come on.
That was a beautiful finish, That was a beautiful finish. And obviously, Marcus Alonso is... I can't remember if he kind of got... The ball kind of took a touch off the defender, but it ricocheted up to his sternum area. And he had his hand on in that area and it literally hit his body. I understand the hand's in an unnatural position or whatever the fuck the criteria is these days. But then he just slammed it into the top corner. Absolutely beautiful. And... I think that was before Timo Werner's goal, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. So
it's just a shame for Chelsea. I mean, fair play to them. On one hand, you've got to congratulate them and commend them for getting back into the tie in that manner, cruising through the game. But also, you have to ask a few questions as to how they capitulated late on, because Tuchel doesn't seem like the kind of coach that you would see that happening to the team performing under his guidance. It was a contradiction, really. Getting back into the game and giving it away again, kind of.
And then, don't forget you're up against an elite coach in Carlo Ancelotti that's been there and done it as well. So it was sometimes when it comes to that nitty gritty, it's just you need a bit of luck. Sometimes you need a little bit of luck. I don't think Chelsea had it on their side that evening. I think they did everything right. I think Tuchel set them up brilliantly. And they were causing havoc in the midfield. I think they had that extra player in midfield that was causing Real Madrid loads of problems. Mason Mount was dropping into great spaces. He was picking up the ball. He was playing forward, being nice and positive. Scored a great goal for the first. I didn't see extra time, so I can't comment too much. I didn't actually see the final goal. But I just think, unfortunate for Chelsea for sure.
Well, congratulations to Real Madrid and their little-known striker, Karim Benzema. Commiserations to Chelsea. But on to the other quarter-final, second leg on Tuesday. And we say good evening to Unai Emery, guiding his Villarreal team through to the semis with a point away at the Allianz against German behemoths Bayern Munich. It took Bayern 52 minutes to break them down. Lewandowski squeezing a low, long-range effort in off the post. And you would have been forgiven for thinking the floodgates were about to open. But Villarreal held strong. And with just 2 minutes of regular time to go, Raul Albiol showed some superb hold-up play in the middle of the park before starting what was basically a rare counter-attack that ended with substitute Samuel Chukwueze bundling the ball into the net and securing a famous victory in the club's history. Difficult not to be chuffed for the underdogs here. And it's that combination of technique, class and quality, and as you were just alluding to, a little bit of luck as well that stomped them through past Bayern Munich. And I was surprised to hear that this was the second year running that Bayern have gone out in the quarters, which it wouldn't have rang true to my ear had I not heard it beforehand.
Yeah, and I think Unai Emery's, European specialist moniker lives on. I think that's four European or Europa League victories in the last 10 years for him. I think he had three on the trot with Sevilla, which is remarkable. Obviously, he had that one with Villarreal where they beat Manchester United, was that last year. And then now he's got them to a Champions League semi-final. It's just really incredible what he's doing in Europe. I don't know what... There's another research topic for Flynn. Why is Unai Emery so good at being able to manage teams in Europe when his team are sat in seventh in La Liga? And does that, and this is a question I was having a debate with Alejandro, one of the coaches, this week. He's big into La Liga, doesn't really watch any Premier League. So he was saying that, La Liga is a better quality than the Premier League. And he was saying to me, if Atleti beat Man City, which they didn't ultimately, but if they did beat them, would that have made La Liga better than the Premier League?
A farcical argument, but sorry, Flynn, I cut you there. Go on.
I was just laughing about that.
Well, it's look, we all know that there are quality teams that come out of La Liga, Serie A, and Ligue 1. But does that mean that the league overall of a commensurate quality? Obviously not. La Liga, I think it's fair to say this, has always been considered a top heavy league. There's two teams that are going to win that. And it's a testament to Diego Simeone and the culture that he's managed to cultivate at Atletico Madrid, that he's brought them onto the periphery of that conversation, you know. But historically, it's been two teams. So I don't know what he's chatting about, mate. You might want to report that fella.
If only there was some sort of special league, like a league of champions, where we could like a champions league, where we could decide this sort of thing. I guess we'll never know.
And it's interesting that you say that about because there was someone on TalkSport, I can't remember who it was now. It's like an ex-player that means nothing to nobody. I think he played for Tottenham for a little bit. He was criticising Diego Simeone's behaviour in the match against Man City, which we're going to talk about now. And he was saying that's why he'll never be coach of one of the big clubs. And I was thinking, mate, did you see Atletico Madrid Stadium? Like the other night against Man City, it was absolutely raucous, man. And they're a huge club. Atletico Madrid, a huge club. They've reached like as many Champions League finals as, well, apart from Liverpool and Man City, who have only reached two, by the way. They've reached as many as Man City and more than any other Premier League club has in the last how many years? I don't know. Since Fergie, you know, his Champions League success at United, RIP. Not RIP, still alive, isn't it? God bless. But I just think that was an incredible statement to make. And, you know, moving to the game, I think it was all out war. And like the high quality generals were all over the pitch. And it had absolutely everything bar goals. And I think when footy gets this criticism of like, and, you know, mainly coming from the sort of American media of not being exciting because it's low scoring, this is the game that you want to show them. Had drama, controversy, pressure, and in the final moments, desperation and then elation for the eventual winners on aggregate, which was Man City. Unbelievable tie. And I think it really shows you how far Man City have come under Guardiola. And, you know, I was alluding to this earlier, but I think this sort of fixture, maybe 2 or 3 years ago, they would have lost because they would have had the same level of ability 2 or 3 years ago, but I don't think they would have had that know-how of how to win in these situations. But now they've been in these situations before in the Champions League, I feel like the players are starting to become aware, a little bit more clued up. And they had to defend, like dogs, man, to be honest, throughout this whole game. And alongside the beautiful football as well that they played. And it was a bit of a contrast with that game against Liverpool where it was all smiles and hugs at the end of the final whistle with Liverpool. It was like two great teams playing at the highest level, the best that they can do. And then in Madrid, it was just like pure angst, aggravation. And like they had to dig really deep. Obviously, you had like little skirmishes with Felipe, who got a red card for the aftermath of his challenge against Foden. You had Stefan Savic, who used to play for Man City and he won a Premier League title there like a decade ago. Listen, he was a dirty dog as well.
I've got a question about that because we spoke earlier and I just thought the officials in that game they just had no control. How do you leave Savic on the pitch? No matter how late it is, he's trying to drag Foden up to his feet. He's pushing the substitute that came along to defend Foden. He's grabbing Aki round the throat. He's pulling Jack Grealish's hair. Wasn't reprimanded at all. Felipe gets a second yellow, probably rightly so, but whatever. How did the officials let it get to that stage? And obviously, he's a high-tempered, emotional, fans are rocking. I get all that, but they've got the technology. They've got the ability to say, look, hold it down for 2 minutes. I'm going to go look at the screen over there. There's no excuse. And there was like several questionable penalty incidents as well, where it's like, what's going on here? It just seemed like the game got away from him, from my perspective.
Yeah, and no, I completely agree. I think he needs help. The referee, isn't this what we got VAR for? It's so that there's a team, there's a panel of, you know, referees that can assist the guy in the middle that's having to deal with all this like shenanigans. I think it was warranted as well. I think the Felipe, it was a booking. I'm not sure if you got a straight red or a second yellow, but it was warranted, man, because the tackle was fine. The initial challenge was fine, but it was that aftermath and he knew what he was doing, man. You could see in his face that he knew what he was doing. He tried to leave a little bit in on Foden And then, yeah, I just say, like, Savic, he was just being, like, the pantomime villain, wasn't he? And, like, he just managed to get away with it all. What did you make of that, the penalty in question? I think it was Cancelo on Correa, I think it was. It looked like Cancelo got a little bit of the ball, but then he got the man as well, and then Correa sort of made a meal out of it. What did you make of it?
I thought it was a penalty, but I didn't look at it. The replay that I saw was from, like, two angles. I didn't get the full, like, what was that game we watched earlier in the season? The Rangers, when Rangers beat Dortmund. That was it.
Yeah.
You got the full 360, slow-mo, all that. I didn't look at it in that detail, but my impressions were that it was a penalty.
That's a fair one. I'm not sure why that wasn't in the highlights. I watched the extended highlights and just it wasn't mentioned, which is a bit of a weird one. But yeah, it was a battle for the ages, let's put it that way. But Man City ultimately went through. Atleti will be... and their fans, their fans stayed in the ground, all of them, like 10 minutes after the game had finished. And they were all just like chanting and cheering. I was like, how can you call that a small club? Or like not allude to it being a massive club, because it really is. And I think Diego Simeone is 100% definitely in the top 10 managers around at the minute. That would be a manager for Manchester United in response to your earlier question.
Nice, nice.
Now that would be a guy that you could bring in to really shake the team up and get them playing in a way that's going to be successful. Because he'd come in and he wouldn't stand for any shit, man. Really regimented. He would get them being defensively stout initially. And then I think you bring players in. And he's shown that he can get the best out of players like João Félix, like Antoine Griezmann, Yannick Carrasco. They've got players they can bring off the bench of high quality. Matias Cunha, I think, who they bought from RB Leipzig. Like, they've got quality all over the pitch. They're not just a team that plays defensively. And I think we saw that, although they didn't score in two legs against Man City. And we did sort of like half sort of criticise them for playing like a back five and playing like a 5-5, as De Bruyne was saying, playing really defensively in their low block. But that's tactics for you, man. You set your team up in the best way that you think that can get the result. And we'll quickly gloss over Liverpool, Benfica. That was a good game. That had lots of goals in it. And what did we learn from it, really? Because Liverpool were practically there from the first leg. They also went 3-1 up. So I think they were 4 goals ahead on aggregate. They looked comfortable. But then Benfica got a couple of goals late on. And that's 5 conceded for Liverpool in the last 2 games. I think after barely conceding that amount, maybe they only conceded 2 or 3 since January, unless I'm mistaken. Like, is this a sign of Liverpool being vulnerable, or is it a case of, you know, them taking the foot off the gas because they already know they're through?
Listen, Klopp will be fuming with that. I think a couple of years ago, didn't Liverpool overturn a similar deficit against Roma? And that's how they got through to the final. I think they lost against Real Madrid to that spectacular overhead kick from Gareth Bale. You've seen other famous instances of that happening when Messi was still at Barcelona against PSG. You know, going into the second leg of a knockout stage tie can be a curse if your opponents turn up with the right attitude. We've got nothing to lose. We're basically beaten already. Let's just throw everything at them. I think Klopp will be fuming, but let's not take away from Benfica's achievement. As an attacking force, and especially with that Nunes as the spearhead, some of the finishes he was pulling out of the bag were ridiculous. And I don't think I've ever seen a game of football, not recently anyway, where there were that many disallowed goals. They were both going for it. But I think one still from the replay springs to mind. There were 2 attacking players from Benfica on the left-hand side, and they had a man over. The whole back 4 from Liverpool was spread over to the opposite side. And I was just thinking, there are acres of space there and there was nothing to stop, just the long ball over the top, nothing to stop it at all. And I was thinking, is that an oversight on Klopp's part? Is that just the way the game's played out and the way it's kind of working? But it seemed to me that they were open all day long and Benfica had the players to exploit it.
Is that going to be Liverpool and Villarreal next then? Can you see Liverpool underestimating them and going as chilled as they were in this game? Do you think Klopp will let that happen?
It's not within Jurgen Klopp's philosophy or makeup or whatever you want to call it to take teams lightly. They'll play exactly the same way as they did against Man City, as they did against Benfica midweek. I don't think they deviate much from their philosophy. I think they'll play in the same way against whatever team. They'll just play attacking. They'll look to be direct in the right areas. Get the ball to their main players. So I think they'll press you all over the pitch, no matter who you are. And which is, I think, is the best way to do it. If you're one of the best teams in the world and you've got some of the best players in the world and you're fit enough to do it, then why not? Do you know what I mean? Press, gegenpress as hard as you can. Win the ball back, be direct, look to exploit the spaces that the opposition leave behind. So I can't see Villarreal getting a result, but I couldn't see them winning two legs over Bayern Munich. Who would have thought they could have come through after two legs against Bayern Munich? So never say never, but I'd say their chances are extremely low. And I think Man City can beat Real Madrid. So I think we'll probably see a Liverpool-Man City final. I wouldn't be surprised at all.
Who would you pick?
If them two go through?
We're almost going to be overdosing on Liverpool versus Man City games, especially after this weekend in the FA Cup semi-final. But I don't know. That's an unfair question to ask, because depending on how the league goes and how the tie goes on Saturday, these are all accumulative factors. But yeah, I hope they both get through. Not on a patriotic level. I just think that they're probably the best two teams in the world. And I think if Bayern have been struggling the last two seasons for whatever reason, I don't know how Nagelsmann's been doing in the Bundesliga. Villarreal are kind of like the wild card. Like, if they went through the next round, that is like pretty spectacular on their part. But you'd have to say quality wise and stature wise and commercial wise and rivalry wise, I want to see Liverpool and Man City in the final.
And I don't think we've seen this for many, many a year. Probably Barcelona, Real Madrid, the last time we've had two teams from the same league that were able to be sort of like as competitive as each other, really. And sort of like, they're both bringing the best, best out of each other in a way. Do you know what I mean? A lot like sort of the sporting rivals from other sports I've done. You know what I mean? You could probably relate it to boxing, where like there's been two rivals that have been really, really, brought the best out of each other. It happens in many, many sports. So I think that's happening right now between Man City and Liverpool.
I think you see that happen in golf quite often, don't you?
And, speaking of golf, Scotty Scheffs, he comfortably wins the Masters at Augusta in 2022 and earns his first ever green jacket along with the first major victory. He was world number one going into the tournament and hot favourite, and he showed every bit of why he's the best golfer in the world right now. It seemed too obvious to have a bet on him. It seemed like, he's won, I think, three out of seven or three out of eight PGA events that he's played in so far this year. He can't win his first Masters this year as well, can he? Yes, he can. He's only 25 as well. He turned professional in 2018. A lot like his compatriot, Colin Morikawa. And now he's had a great start to the year. There was also a spirited performance for Rory McIlroy, who I said had been out of sorts for a long time and had no chance. But that's going to give him confidence. He finished second. He put some pressure on Scheffler in the end. I think he had a chip in from birdie from like the greenside bunker on the 18th. That brought him up to like 7 under, but it was nobody got near Scheffler on the final day. And it was just a comfortable performance, really. And our boys, Morikawa and Zalatoris, which are each way bets from last weekend, they both placed in the top 10. Shane Lowry and Corey Connors had good final days, but yeah, nobody could get near Scheffler.
And wasn't it true that Tiger Woods kind of had to battle through a pretty significant injury to finish one of the courses on one of the days? I think I heard that on one of the podcasts I was listening to. Did his body give out mid-Masters, as it were?
Yeah, I think, and that was always going to be the worry, coming back from that horrific car crash and with the sort of, the amount of pressure that it puts on your body. You know what I mean? It really does. Like 4 days, you wouldn't think, golfing, you think, oh, it's a bit of a walk in the park. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't really put much strain on you physically, but it absolutely does. And what's Woods, he's like mid-40s. He's come back from that injury that he had where I think there was questions of him being amputated at one point. So, and then you've got to walk around for 4 days and play shots. You know, all, and it's not just like flat either. It's like all these hilly, undulating, you know, fairways and stuff like that. Up, down in the bunker, up you get. So it's tough, man. I can understand why, you know, he wasn't allowed to last physically. Go on, Finn. I can see you smiling like a Cheshire cat.
I mean, you say it's no walk in the park, but they literally are walking around a park. It might be a fairly hilly park, deceptively hilly park, but it's just walking around a park.
It's just not a walk in the park, is it, mate?
That's what right, I'm saying. It's no driving around Spain and Portugal, but like it's still physically, it can be physically demanding for sure when you're out in the baking hot sun for like 4 hours.
No, it definitely is, man. We went to the driving range for like an hour and a half. And my back was wrecked. And we were just standing there. I couldn't even hit the ball straight. So if you're hiking around wherever you're hiking around and doing that, especially
Georgia.
Georgia. obviously it's a bit facetious to say it's not physically taxing. But I think the difference is when you see a fella standing there for 2 minutes and just swinging a club once, and then you see lads from the NFL smashing through brick walls and that, it suffers by comparison, doesn't it?
Can trick the mind. It can definitely trick the mind. But let's do the five things. Number one, Isco has responded to claims he is the mole in the Real Madrid dressing room, that he's apparently leaking their starting lineups to the media. He has responded by saying it's impossible for him to be the mole because Carlo Ancelotti does not invite him to team meetings. Like, surely that confirms that he is the mole.
He's definitely the fucking mole. Did you see the tweet from him as well saying he's not the mole? He's written it in the third person. He says, Isco is not the mole.
Oh, convincing.
Proper convincing, that is, mate.
But yeah, apparently in the Spanish press, Carlo Ancelotti's been on the hunt for someone within the club who's been leaking his lineups to radio stations several hours before kickoff. So he's tried to combat this mole situation by naming his starting 11 2 hours before kickoff rather than the usual 1 hour. Like, that's going to help matters. But yeah, for sure, Isco's the mole.
As if you have to contend with things like that, man. It's like when Jamie Vardy's misses and Colleen Rooney got into it. And it was like, yeah, you're the fucking bitch that's been leaking my secrets to the press. And it, by process of elimination, Carlo Ancelotti just slowly circled his way towards Isco. It's what Isco's trying to play it cool. He doesn't even invite me to team meetings, man. I don't know why. It's unreal. Maybe because I'm telling everyone his fucking secrets.
The leak stopped happening after he started inviting him.
And how'd you go about disciplining him for that? Like, do you know what I mean? What would you do? Like, give him, I don't know, like a couple of weeks wages, like ban or whatever? I don't know.
Oh, he gives. Oh, oh, I've got, oh, 150 grand. Stop it for 1 week. What are you going to do?
What's he getting out of it, though? So presumably he's leaking it, what, for money? But the dude now, has what, plenty.
Nobody's going to, like, he's getting 150 a week. Like, the Spanish media ain't going to pay him, like, anything near that. Oh, I'll give you 275 grand for the team news, man. Come on.
Yeah, just every and next Saturday as well. Yeah, nice one.
Maybe we want to be first on the team news. Like, we don't want to be 30 seconds after when we see it on Twitter. We want to be first to break it.
Maybe he just fancies the bird at the radio station. Simple as that. Occam's razor, innit?
I think that's probably the best solution. But number two, Russian karting driver Artem Severukin has been sacked and under FIA investigation after making a Nazi salute on the podium as he celebrated his victory in round one of the FIA Karting European Championship. High quality sporting tournament there in Portugal. What do you make of this?
Free Artem. That's what I say. No, I'm only joking. Obviously. What would compel a person in the 21st century, anyone of reasonable body and mind, to make a Nazi salute on a podium on a sporting event? Why would he do that? Even if that's his like cherished belief, his mistaken cherished belief, why would he do that in front of people? He deserves the whatever sanction he gets, man, to be honest with you.
Forlan deserves it. But this is the guy who's like 15, isn't he? I think I saw footage of this. And
that changes things.
It looks like, it just looks like a dumb kid playing up, to be fair.
Oh, sorry, did I not mention that he's 15? Yeah, like, yeah, yeah.
So oh, okay. Oh, well, in that case, then I
look at me manipulating the news.
I know, yeah. Left wing Bissett.
Fuming. BBC.
Mainstream media over here.
I know. But yeah, if he, again, obviously that's an inappropriate thing to do, but framing it like that, it's a 15-year-old doing it. I would be horrified to look back into each of our pasts and see what we were acting like when we were 15. Yeah, exactly. We're all shaking our heads right now. I can't rightly condemn this kid. Obviously.
No, I'm shaking my head because I'm pretty sure I didn't do anything that horrific.
I hope the combination of poor internet connection and us laughing will cover that out. So you have to cut it out in the edit. But if you can do it, I don't care.
All right, number three. And I can't remember if we had this on the podcast in April, but it's worth a reminder. Antoine Griezmann, he can breathe a sigh of relief as April the 8th has passed again for another year. Because in 2016, 2019 and 2021, him and his lovely wife, Erica Chopperina, have had a child on exactly the same date. And I'm not sure what the XG stats are for that and what odds Pat Bissett would be laying. But I'd say the odds are pretty slim.
Tell you what, they've been laying something down in the Griezmann house, I'll tell you what, bro. But yeah, we did cover this last year on the pod. And I don't know, it kind of goes back to that. If you've got that kind of money, would he really be breathing a sigh of relief? He hasn't got the same constraints as the rest of us. They say it takes like 180 grand to raise a kid from like zero to 18. That's like half a week's wages for Griezmann. He should have had twins this year, greedy bastard.
Spoken like a man that, and the same as me, that knows nothing about bringing up children, but they can be monumental pain in the ass, man. I don't think he's worried about the money. I think he's worried about actually bringing up a small human being that like just cries and just shits everywhere and that like constantly wants feeding.
Oh, we'll be doing that. Consuela. I think our preamble chat, well, pre-podcast chat has managed to sneak its way into the podcast. So I'm going to move swiftly on to number four for the five things you might have missed.
And it needs to be swift.
Definitely. Former UFC flyweight and bantamweight champion Henry Cejudo has re-entered the USADA testing pool following his retirement in May of 2020. This has, of course, sparked rumours that we'll be seeing Triple C back in competitive action sometime in the near future. Now, Henry Cejudo is an Olympic gold medalist, a member of the exclusive Champ Club, alongside Conor McGregor, Amanda Nunes, and Daniel Cormier. And he's stayed close to the sport ever since retiring. What time is Conor?
Oh, mate. Every Christmas I watch that.
Which film?
Fucking brilliant. Conor.
Oh, massive, yeah.
Mate, tie a ribbon around the old oak tree because daddy's coming home. Love it, man. Put the bunny back in the box.
Put the bunny back in the box. All right, go from many fighters, Jim.
Okay, let me just get the screen back up here. 1 second.
Try to find the same level of enthusiasm as you just had as well.
Do. Okay, 3, 2, 1. And many fighters, including John Jones, have been seen training with Cejudo, who recently helped the Korean Zombie for his preparations against Alexander Volkanovski last weekend, which we'll talk about in a bit.
And speaking of Volkanovski, Cejudo's called him out on Twitter. So he's been quoted as saying, "I know I could beat Alex Volkanovski. I want to become the first 3-division champion in UFC history." Or he could just shut up the cringe. It would be a treat for the fans.
It's interesting, isn't it, man? Because Henry Cejudo is pretty much as elite as it gets when it comes to combat sports athletes. And Dana White has recently come out and said, no, not Dana White. That's another thing for Aljamain Sterling lately. Michael Bisping came out and said he'd be too small to fight Alexander Volkanovski. And I think that, to me, they look basically the same size, man. They're both short asses, like powerful guys, completely competent. When it comes to that level, size is less of an issue than you would think, but we are going to touch upon that a lot in the combat sports section, so we won't go too much into it here. We'll go on to number five, and the US ambassador to Ireland, Claire Cronin, has announced that the US Treasury has put up a $5 million reward for anyone who can provide information leading to the, quote, financial destruction of alleged mobster Daniel Kinahan. Daniel Kinahan has been accused of accumulating over $1 billion in wealth through drug trafficking and associated activities. why are we talking about him? Well, boxing fans will know Kinahan as the man who started MTK Global in 2012, a management company that has a massive number of prominent boxers signed to it, including the WBC heavyweight champion Tyson Fury. Now, Kinahan has since parted ways with MTK, at least on an official level, but has retained a close relationship with Fury and others in the sport. However, Irish Police Commissioner Drew Harris has sent a warning shot to broadcasters, promoters, and anyone else that they should stay away from Kinahan or they'll be considered part of a, quote, criminal network. So it seems to me that the noose is tightening, and this could have massive ramifications for the sport because of just how far the tentacles spread. I don't want to use like a well-worn mobster-related metaphor, but I think this guy's money goes everywhere, like including like Pro Bellum, and that like that's completely unfounded, but that's what I've heard online. So I'm reporting it as news here. But I just want to say that as far as Daniel Kinahan goes, I actually stood in the same room as him. I was sitting in Matthew Macklin's dressing room before his fight with Jason Wellborn in 2015. And I've got to say, he seemed like a nice enough chap, although the allegations against him are pretty serious. This could be a pretty significant point in the sport.
We've talked now and then about doing a Ball Chat Investigates kind of episode, like CEI Ball Chat. We've been talking about doing one of these sorts of kind of episodes at one point. Like, you know, we could look into a specific case of sports corruption. This might not be a bad topic for that episode.
Yeah, well, I'm not trying to get shot in the head, mate. I'm not saying I would get shot in the head because Daniel Kinahan and his associates seem like gentlemen and I'm not putting a foot wrong in that respect. But yeah, I might just leave it alone. I'm not getting paid for this shit, man.
Flynn, you're gonna have to do the expose then.
Yeah, that's all you, Flynn. That is all you. So on the back of that, swiftly moving on, because I see there's a Volkswagen Passat with an Irish number plate just cruising up to my front window right now. Why have they got them balaclavas on? It's not even cold. Weird. So we'll go on to the featured fights and the retrospective from last week. And it is the big one, the one we were all gassed about, UFC 273. We'll start with the main event, Alexander Volkanovski versus the Korean Zombie for the featherweight title. Now, Volkanovski hit Zombie so hard and so often, his conscience compelled him to check if his opponent was all right at the start of the fourth round. Zombie looked every inch of his nickname as he nodded that he was fine, after which Volkanovski let rip with a leg kick and two right hands that could have... There are times when fights cross that boundary between competition and sadism, and I think that's when that happened. That forced referee Herb Dean to step in with 45 seconds gone in the fourth round. For me, it was as close to a perfect performance as you're likely to see in the UFC cage, a notoriously unpredictable arena.
I thought that was a really good stoppage from Herbal Dean there. So like Zombie was still standing when it happened, and I think a lesser ref would have let that punishment continue. And you got to respect the Korean Zombie, but I just don't know if he's got much left in him now. Do you reckon?
Did you watch this one, Bissett?
I was in a bar in NYC. I was intoxicated, it has to be said.
No, I refuse to believe it.
So as you know, man, when you're watching fights, when you're intoxicated, you don't remember the particulars. But yeah, it just looked like what a masterclass. Like, and for Volkanovski, as you just said, man, is he 28 or is it 29-1 now?
I think so. Yeah. 29-1 now.
That's an outrageous like record. You just don't see it. Do you in the UFC? Like you don't see, I don't know who was his loss to.
I think it was early on in his career in the kind of feeder organizations that lead to the UFC. And obviously, like, Kamaru Usman's got a loss early on in his career by rear naked choke, which is the last method of loss you'd attribute to him. But it's learning fights, and MMA is good like that. A loss doesn't necessarily end your ascent or the hype job or whatever. But he's a man in that zone right now. He had the size disadvantage. He's only 2 years younger than Korean Zombie. who I've got to say gave up all of his natural advantages. He was the taller man, he was the longer man. He was leaning forward, flat-footed, and Volkanovski was just so sharp, so decisive, so defensively astute. Every time he'd land a punch, he'd constantly be covering up. He didn't take anything for granted in that fight. And he just showed that he was the champion. I'm looking forward to the next time he fights Max Holloway, because that is the fight to see who's the best featherweight in the company. But in chief support, Aljamain Sterling and Peter Yan fought their rematch for the bantamweight strap. Now, I have to be honest, Aljamain Sterling shocked me. I did not expect this performance from him. After Yan's performance and the disqualification, which resulted in him winning the title in the first fight, and his emotional outburst on the scales before this one, but Aljamain Sterling, for me, didn't appear like he was going to win this fight or he was going to upend anything from the first fight. I was certain Peter Yan was going to beat him. But Sterling, he walked into the cage as a different man. He was slimmer. He was more evasive and prepared for Yan's spinning attacks off the break, and which saved him a lot of problems throughout the fight. He controlled Yan for almost all of the second and third rounds with some of the slickest back takes I've ever seen. Not only was he more effective with his takedowns, he was jumping on Yan's tendency to turn his back when he was getting up. It just said to me that he was fully prepared. And I had him winning the second and third, but Yan came back into it in the fourth and fifth. I had him winning both those rounds. The first round for me was a coin toss, and Sterling got the result. Some people have called this controversial. Not for me. I could see it go either way. But if there was a gun to my head, I would say Sterling won this fight.
Some people, including Dana White, he said, I think in the post-fight scrum, he said that he reckons the judges got it wrong and that he had Yan winning it. But I've got to say, as close as it was, yeah, I'm 100% with you on this one, Jim. Sterling played it smart and he did the whole tactical thing and went for points, and he got a pretty deserved victory in my book.
And I think credit to him and his team as well with the way they've approached it, because they've obviously learned from the first fight. Even though he came out the victor in that instance, albeit due to disqualification, he definitely came out with a new strategy in terms of how to deal with Yan. And I think he did deal with him. Obviously, you mentioned Dana White, who was like shaking his head at the end, wasn't he? Looked to like sort of like when they announced who'd won. I've seen people on the Source of All Knowledge Twitter saying that like it's like a robbery. But every time, it seems that every time there's a fight that doesn't quite go your way, or it's a close one that goes one way, because it has to go one way, it's always like, oh, it's a robbery. But some of the stats regarding the fight, so total strikes, 91 to Sterling, 139 to Yan. Significant strikes was very close, 62 to Sterling, 63 to Yan. And then takedowns, which Yan didn't attempt one. And Sterling only managed 2 of his 22 attempts, which is 9%. So yeah, takedown defense was good by Yan. Yan, obviously, that, you know, that wasn't going to be part of his game. So he went, you know, he was high up on the total strikes. It's difficult to decipher based on the stats. So, you know.
But listen, that's where Aljamain Sterling made his biggest improvements. I thought in the first fight that even though Sterling came in there as the grappler and Yan came in there as the striker, I thought Yan was dominant in the grappling exchanges. And in this fight, on the slightest invitation, Sterling was on his back, sinking in those chokes. He had the body triangle in and he would hold him there. He'd punch him. He would try and work for the choke. And credit to Petr Yan, he did a really good job defending. I don't think there's many other fighters in the division that would be able to have Aljamain Sterling on their back and not get choked out. So he needs a lot of respect on that level. And to come back and finish strong in the fourth and fifth, I just think that Aljamain Sterling, as you say, learned a lot. His team learned a lot and they capitalized and they performed. I know I predicted Petr Yan would just dominate this fight, but I was very, very impressed by Aljamain Sterling and the adjustments he made. And speaking of the subjective nature of scoring, people called that a robbery or it's controversial. I don't think so. But I think the same label could be applied to the people's main event, certainly the Ball Chat's main event. Khamzat Chimaev against Gilbert Burns. Nakamza edged Burns by a 3-round split decision. He proved he's got an iron chin. He proved that he had a desire to entertain. And with this win, he's catapulted himself all the way up to third in the welterweight rankings. Now, for me, I actually thought Burns won the fight. I got to be honest. I thought Khamzat won the first, punctuating it by knocking Burns down with a jab late on. Burns landed some atomic bombs in the second round, dropping Khamzat in turn. And I cannot believe that Khamzat was still conscious after Burns landed that right hook. And as it goes for the third round, I thought Khamzat started really strongly. But over the course of the round, I thought Gilbert Burns did the better work. And I can see Flynn shaking his head. I'm open to the riposte. I'm not even mad at this result. I thought he was by the slightest of margins again. But I honestly thought Gilbert Burns did enough to win this fight.
You're talking absolute pup there, man. super close. In my opinion, Khamzat 100% had that last round. I think I've read that Burns landed more strikes and significant strikes, but just the whole vibe a bit, Khamzat was directing most of that third round, I reckon, just from general vibes. But I got to say, I had this one all wrong last week. I had Khamzat just steamrolling Burns in round one. That's why I was excited. But I'm glad that we got the fight that we got, because this was way more exciting than anything I could have hoped for. Amazing performance from the both of them. What I loved, and I've watched a lot of replays over this, is Hamzat's takedown defense. That was off the scale. Like how much strength he had just to kind of center all his weight and just not let Burns take him down. And then it was one of them. I've seen him do this before in a previous fight, I think maybe pre-UFC. He's got this vicious counter uppercut. And he only seems to whip it out when people try to take him down. And he just managed one. I don't think he connected fully, but he managed to slip one in during one of Burns' takedown attempts. It was brilliant. Got to say, though, second round, Burns almost had the whole fight there when he knocked Khamzat down. Like, that shot would have knocked out most people living. That was incredible. And like what you said, Jim, yeah, we know the dude's got a chin now. We know the pair of them have a chin. They're made of fucking granite, these two. It was amazing.
And a quick question, should this round been over, if it was 5 rounds, would we have had the same result, do you think?
Ooh. I think Khamzat would have won over 5 rounds.
Ooh, a lot of people saying Khamzat looks super gassed, but for me, they both look super gassed. And yeah, in a five-round, you'd pace yourself a lot better if that was five rounds.
But I think they're... Sorry, I keep fucking trying to jump over you there. But I think... because Gilbert Burns, especially in the third round, he was swinging big. And it just so happened, for me, from my perspective, he was landing more than his fair share. But as you say, you pace yourself different. I don't think he's winging those shots in the third round. And I think Khamzat might have been a bit more sensible in rounds 4 and 5 than he was in rounds 1, 2, and 3. Because for me, he fought quite recklessly, which will be... is punctuated by his coach's comments, which you sent to us in the group chat, didn't you, Bissett?
Yeah, so he was saying... No, I think it was you, Flynn, but wasn't he saying that his coach was saying, go steady, just like, you don't need to get into a brawl with him, basically, do you know what I mean? But he didn't want to do that, which is, you know, credit to Khamzat and what he's trying to create, the legacy he's trying to create for himself, which is he wants to be an entertainer as well at the same time, do you know what I mean? Even though it was at a detriment to his chances of winning this fight, like he went in there and he just like traded blows with Gilbert Burns, who, like, as I say, he was never going to go into that fight and be rolled over by Khamzat. And I think that is a great test. What a great test for Khamzat. But, you know, the question is, like, he's definitely not ready for Usman right now. So is he even ready for Colby? Like, would that be the fight for him? Or would he want to take somebody, I think is like Bilal Muhammad, I think he's fighting this weekend. Like, would someone like that be a better fit for him right now instead of being shoved? Because, like, I think if he goes into the octagon with Usman, it's going to be, I don't know.
I reckon, I agree with you that he's not ready right now for Colby or Usman. Maybe he could handle Colby. I don't think he would hit as hard as Burns did in that in that fight, but I think Hamzat might have him on the wrestling. But either way, Colby's cardio is just out of control, isn't it? And I think he could get Hamzat based on that right now. But I think Hamzat learned a lot. I think he even knows that right now. I think now he's had a taste of real top five competition. He knows what he needs to do now because he could have lost that. And he was a bit too cocky before that fight. And I think he's smart enough to work on that now for, I don't know, however many months to go for someone like Colby. And for me, the next fight has to be Colby. He's beaten the number two guy. He's got to take the number one contender next. It's got to be done. It's just whether or not Colby's smart enough or dumb enough to take that fight.
You know, I think Khamzat is a very bad matchup for Colby. I mean, referencing back to what you said about every time Gilbert Burns tried to take Khamzat down, it was stuffed before it could even get anywhere near being started. And I thought that struck me more than anything else in the fight. When Gilbert Burns shot for a takedown, Khamzat was like, nope, in a bit, mate. Not happening. And Colby Covington's game is strike, 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 shoot for the takedown. So what does Colby Covington do when he can't take him down? Because Khamzat's still unbelievably huge for the weight. And also, I don't think, like, if Khamzat is circumspect and cautious and is not as willing to give the fans a show, I think you see a whole nother level to that guy. I really do. And I don't think we've seen 50% so far, to be honest with you.
So let's say that fight gets set up. So Covington takes that fight. Obviously, our boy Leonard Edwards needs his opportunity. He needs his opportunity, Usman. So I'd be disgusted if he doesn't get that chance. And then when Usman beats Edwards, which is most likely to happen, then you set up the Khamzat Usman fight, should he beat Covington. I think that's pretty much the way it's going to pan out, isn't it?
I want the Burns rematch. I want these two to fight again. I think there was enough in that fight to do that again. You don't have to get Colby involved. You can think of Colby now, with his persona, he's a marketable character. Put him against someone else. Give Leon the chance he deserves. I mean, Usman, he's three fights away from retirement. And if I was him, I'd be thinking, yeah, Khamzat can feast on the rest of these geezers when I'm getting out of here with my reputation intact.
Have you seen, here's a good idea of how it should go. And this was suggested by Burns himself. I think he tweeted out something like, look, I want my rematch, but you go have a couple more fights first. So obviously kind of hinting that you go beat Colby, work up, beat Usman and give me the title shot, basically. And I think he's done Khamzat a solid. He was the number two guy and he took on a fight against this number 11 guy. Yeah. Against all like sound advice, he gave this monster a shot. So Hamza's got a lot to thank him for. And I reckon he could wonder if he gets good enough, if he beats Colby and he works fucking hard, he could beat Usman one day. I could see it happening. Then gives Burns his rematch. I think that would be the cool way to do it.
Listen, Khamzat, he had nothing but respect for Gilbert Burns at the end of that fight. And it really endeared me to him more. His performance endeared me to him, but his words afterwards put a little exclamation point on that. We'll have to see how it goes. I want the rematch. You never know with Fathead Dana what's going on. But we will move on to the boxing from last weekend. And Gennady Golovkin beat Ryoto Murata by a ninth round TKO in Saitama. And if memory serves correct, I think I called eighth round stoppage last week. I was 3 minutes away. Gee, I could have had Bissett's pants down over that, mate. But Gennady Golovkin, he unified two middleweight belts, keeping his trilogy dream alive against Canelo Alvarez. For me, Golovkin looked as muscular and as slow as I've ever seen him. He's clearly past his peak, but he still had enough to whip this young pup in his backyard. Murata was game. He kept coming forward, even hurting Golovkin in the third round with a body shot. But as the fight devolved into a shootout, which was, for me, below Golovkin, the more durable fighter, the more hard-hitting fighter was able to land some spectacular punches en route to a stoppage. Golovkin's 40 years old. He's a living legend, man. That's all I've got to say about him. To be honest with you, Canelo will cut him up. They're not on the same level at the minute. That's just, I half don't want to see that fight, to be honest with you. But also, Ryan Garcia, fresh tattoos and all, he snoozed his way to a 12-round decision against Manny Togo, while Erickson Lubin and Sebastian Fundora put on a mini classic for the 154-pound title. Fundora is 6'6" and weighs in at 154 pounds. It's alarming to look at that he's, yeah, I can see Flynn doing the maths in his head right now. Just look at a picture of this guy. It's ridiculous. Lubin was forced to retire at the end of the 9th round and he had a face like a bag of spanners. It was as simple as that. Afterwards, Fundora called out Jermell Charlo, who's rematching Brian Castaño for the undisputed light middleweight title in May after their split decision draw last July. Fun times ahead at super welterweight. And for the look ahead, I'm going to go on, because this weekend is actually quite significant in terms of the overall welterweight picture. We've got Errol Spence Jr. versus your Dennis Ugas for the IBF, WBC and WBA welterweight titles. This is supposed to lead to the undisputed title fight with Terence Crawford, who owns the only erstwhile belt in that collection, the WBO. He's recently beaten Sean Porter. Errol Spence, as I've mentioned a lot of times on this podcast, he had that horrific car crash a few years ago. His career was supposed to be over. He was driving his Mercedes supercar down a Dallas highway at 200 miles an hour with no seatbelt on, pissed out of his head. He crashes, the car flips about 20 times and he gets thrown out of it, and he fights like 6 months later against Danny Garcia, absolutely schooling him. Suffers a torn retina after the fact. He's back in business now for the first time in, when was his last fight? Since December 2020. And your Dennis Ugas, obviously coming off that famous win against Manny Pacquiao, which was... Oh, this is now my internet's going slow. Your Dennis Ugas coming off that famous win against Manny Pacquiao in July last year. This is quite a big fight, man. I expect Errol Spence to win just because he is that guy. The only other person like that in the division is Terence Crawford. And for a variety of broadcasting, sanctioning bodies and promotional reasons, them two have been circling around each other for the last 3-4 years. Even if this goes Errol Spence's way, I wouldn't hold my breath for that super fight with Terence Crawford, even though I would hope it would go that way. Also, we've got Conor Benn coming in hot with a 4-month turnaround against another former Errol Spence Jr. victim, Chris Van Heerden. I expect this to go similarly, the way the Chris Algieri fight went. You've got a name guy who's nearing 40 years old. I expect Conor Benn to knock him out, and that's him cursed. And the Boxer Series returns this weekend with the lightweight tournament in Coventry. Jimmy Hutton and Young Jalen will be going to that one. Sky VIP and Ben Shalom coming through with those free tickets again. Mashallah. 1FC aren't back until the 22nd with Erksel Vysadikovic for their lightweight kickboxing title.
I thought Jimmy just randomly, I don't know, I thought he happened upon these tickets. He gets them like on the regs.
Now, Sky Boxing do like a thing, like a pool of like long-term Sky TV subscribers that will give you the opportunity to go into this lottery to get boxing tickets.
He's won it twice in a month.
Yeah, but obviously, I don't know how many people are applying for it, man. He's won it. He's won tickets to other things as well. Like Sky have got coming through with the raffles, man. Absolutely killing it.
Top bowlers.
Bellator 277 is back on Friday, headlined by AJ McKee versus Patricio Pitbull for the featherweight championship. And that is on the BBC for British fans. I always miss Bellator cards and then they pop up and I always forget it's on the BBC. So hopefully all the British fans can tune in there. It'll be on iPlayer for the foreseeable as well. They've got a big playlist on there. And finally, the UFC's back on Sunday with another fight night card. Vicente Luque versus Bilal Muhammad to top the bill. And that's 5th versus 6th at welterweight. That's actually like a really high quality main event in terms of the welterweight rankings. And obviously applicable to Hamza and Kamaru Usman and all that, as we were just talking about. So I think that's everything for the combat sports this week.
I just looked at that Fundora dude. What the fuck is going on with that?
Yeah, same. what a strip of piss, man. Like, he's fucking huge, ain't he? But
and you know what's weird? He doesn't even fight as you'd expect him to fight. He gets close to his opponents, as close as possible.
Why?
This is how to use your natural... This is how not to use your natural skills, isn't it?
Yeah, how not to use your natural skills and still win. He batters, lads. He, honestly, you want to see...
abilities of long reach, and then you just get getting on the inside as a geezer. Why?
But honestly, you want to see Lubin's face at the end of that fight, man. He battered him, and it's like exactly that. I'm twice your height, and I've got twice the reach. Can I just stand as close as possible to you? That'd be sweet.
So what time is that fight going to be? Is that I guess that's over in US, isn't it? Errol Spence. It's got to be Vegas, is it?
It is in the AT&T Stadium in Arlington, Texas. I don't know how that affects... What time zone would that be for you?
Dallas Cowboys Stadium. It's probably a couple of hours difference. So main event's going to be... It's going to be like midnight, isn't it? So yeah, I'll probably tune into that one. That sounds like an interesting fight. Obviously, it's got a bit of context to it as well. So yeah, could be quite interesting. And obviously, you want that Crawford-Spence fight, don't you? That's going to be a fight for the ages if it comes about.
To be fair, I want Errol Spence to batter him just because he beat Manny Pacquiao. Do you know what I mean?
How dare he beat Pacquiao?
How dare he lay gloves on the Filipino idol? That's what I'm saying.
All right. Thank you for listening once again. We will be back next week with more ball chat. This should be out by like Saturday morning, I guess. Yeah. So
depends who's editing. We'll talk about that off air.
All right. Thanks for listening. See you later.
Cheers, everyone.
Respect, man.